Welcome back to the Defining the Relationship podcast. This is our fourth installment connected to the special course that we are doing, the Healing Haunted Histories course. And so it's specifically tailored to people who are taking the course, but we know there's many people that have been tuning in who aren't doing the course, and hopefully we've been able to get into some conversations that are significant to you as well. And maybe you'll find yourself, at very least, maybe picking up the Healing Haunted Histories book by Elaine Enns and Ched Myers and getting into that. But I'm Ted, and Darlene is also with us.
Hi there.
Hello. Today we're doing this podcast a little bit later in the day. We've been blessed with our first snowfall of the year, and
hashtag blessed.
Blessed. Did I say blessed?
Yes.
We're thankful that the fireplace is roaring, so we have that to keep us at least a little bit comforted.
Mm-hmm.
So, we've got lots to get to today. We want to transition into the second part of the restorative solidarity model or wheel that we have been dealing with. The first part is to do our own work. And so the last couple of sessions, we've been focusing on where we find ourselves. And specifically last session, we looked a bit at our own family lines, our land lines, our bloodlines, and our song lines. So if you're wondering what those things are, you can listen to episode 40, which we recorded last week, and I got into those things. But today we want to move to the part of the restorative solidarity model, which is reckoning with harms and responsibilities. Now, that's both a personal and a collective work of learning about and acknowledging the harms of history and seeing where they intersect with our own settler history and our present experience of privileges. So that's a big job, both in the extent of the harms and the responsibility that lays on us as settlers. And also it's a big job because it involves I think going a little bit deeper into how we interact with those harms and responsibilities, specifically how we sometimes make sidesteps where we try to get away from, taking the full responsibility of what has happened and maybe our parts in it or our ancestors' parts in it. So we're going to get into a whole area of moves to innocence, which is a bit of a weighty topic. So I think I'd like to talk a little bit about this theme of responsibility. It's both the word responsibility, which is how we think about basically taking ownership for issues that we are dealing with. And responsibility means acknowledging the truth of the reality of a situation and saying, okay, what do we need to apologize for? What do we need to change in our behavior? How can we be a part of restoration, healing, reconciliation? So in our country, the Truth and Reconciliation Commission work that was done in the last number of decades was all about, on one hand, highlighting the history, the truth of the history, maybe learning about things that we weren't aware of, and making recommendations about how we could move towards bringing about some kind of restoration, reconciliation between settlers and Indigenous people. So this is not something that we aren't aware of. But in this course, we want to think a little bit deeper about how our ability to respond to the restoration, reconciliation conversation, what could be things that might make it difficult for us to enter that into that in a way that is actually helpful and actually restorative to Indigenous people. So we want to talk about the obstacles that get in the way of that. And I think part of it is that there's a lot for us to learn and metabolize in our own stories. And one of the things we've been doing over the past number of weeks is trying to understand a fuller story of our history and our personal stories. Like, no fault of our own, we've been handed stories, handed narratives about who we are as people, who we are as families. And the work that we've been doing is to go a little bit deeper into that and say, okay, well, you know, why weren't we talking about this? Or why is there, for example, in my own family story, we had people arrive in this country on this land at the very time that the first treaties were being signed between Canada and the Indigenous people. And I grew up not knowing anything about that. And people were living in close proximity to each other, and yet there is like very little talk about that. And so wanting to dig deeper into that.
The restorative kind of responsibility is just getting closer to it, right? And like it's, I think as we talk today about some hard things, maybe it's a good place to start that often when something might come at us with like a little bit of truth that is hard to hear, our first reaction, mine included, is, you know, how can I get this off of me? Like, this isn't my thing. I don't like the feeling of it. So it feels uncomfortable. So I just like, just try to move it off of myself.
Yeah.
And as we kind of talk about our moves to innocence, we're going to go through 10 of the different moves that are, I'm guessing Elaine and Ched wrote them down because they heard them enough over time. They felt them in themselves as they've been researching and as they've been kind of doing this work for many years. I think these are things that as I went through them, I was like, oh boy, done that.
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah. They, you know. Yeah. Elaine and Ched are actually borrowing from Tuck and Yang, who wrote an article called Decolonization is Not a Metaphor. And they they provided these 10 moves to innocence that I think, there's a little bit of an ouch factor when you start to think through them. And, do you want to say a bit why you think that's a reflexive response? Like even in us, in people who are hoping to make some progress in terms of restoring relationships with Indigenous people and want to take for example, the TRC kind of seriously in our country, why are we prone to do that?
I don't know. Maybe there's multiple reasons for it, but I think in some ways it's easier to engage with something at a kind of a bigger theoretical level, or we can kind of agree that in general, you know, these things happened and it wasn't good. But as soon as it comes closer and closer and closer, to put myself into the picture, the level of vulnerability is raised.
Mm-hmm.
So that is hard.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. I think you're right. I think also there's that psychological, cognitive bias of, I think it's called the law of attribution. And it's a lot easier for us to think about our own struggles and the things that we have to deal with. And we tend to view them through the lens of, like the circumstances that we had to wrestle through were hard. And so decisions we made were decisions we had to make. It was about survival. We were doing the best we could to get through a hard situation. And then when we overlay that on other people or other groups of people that we aren't as close to, we look at it and go like, wow, why did they make those decisions? There must be something wrong with their character, their culture. They're not as good as us or something. And so we have that kind of that sort of hypocritical stance that we look at ourselves with a lot of generosity, but we look at others with a lot more judgment.
That seems to be a pretty classic thing that we humans do.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so the gift of going through this process is a collectively with a group of other people saying, we're going to step into the story and we're going to try to see more of it.
Right.
See all the colors, see all the cracks, see more things.
Right.
And be generous with ourselves and with others.
Yeah.
And also be willing to challenge ourselves and others. So our job, I think, and I think Indigenous friends need this from us in the church to not just disengage from it and say, yeah, the church really screwed up with Indigenous peoples and residential schools. Oh, they really screwed up. And leave it at that.
Right.
Our task is to engage with it and to move through both de-assimilating but not disassociating, which Chet and Elaine talk about in the book as well. And I don't know if we maybe don't want to get into that, but I think some of the ways in which we are called to kind of de-assimilate might wrongly make us disassociate, but I think that's, we have to kind of hold those two, do one but not the other.
Hmm.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, I think so. I think what you're saying is that we have to unlearn and some ways of operating, which is a work of kind of taking stuff apart and looking at it and putting it aside, but at the same time be willing to kind of get close and personal with the reality. Mm-hmm. And
like, for example, just give it super quick picture. Like growing up, we drove from North Kildonan to church several times a week on Sargent, through downtown, through Logan. And there's a story, a narrative we were given. Logan in Maine is where things get bad, and we lock our doors and we see Indigenous people, and they're, we have a story about them. And it's pretty much a single story.
Right.
And when we start to do this work, we start to look around for the different things that we might see in that story. Mm. Right. And was it just that they're messed up people? We have to lock our doors because they're dangerous. And how do we kind of, how has that positioned me as a superior person,
right,
in my life, always having seen them as less than?
Right.
And, you know, having over the last couple of years thought more closely about how I have disassociated from the entanglement of Mennonite Indigenous overlap.
Right.
I've completely not seen it. Like, right, all kinds of things I've completely not seen. And so the process of seeing things that I haven't ever seen is hard because I've missed a lot of really important things.
Right. Yeah, that's so good. I mean, and telling that story that you were given in a fuller way means asking questions about, well, where, how did it get to this point? Like the reality of poverty, addiction that can be seen in inner city Winnipeg, that's something that definitely can be seen. Where does that come from? And then you start to unpeel the history and you start thinking about, oh, residential school survivors, people who survived a culture being torn away from them, a language being lost, physical, sexual abuse. I mean, there's like layers and layers of trauma and generational trauma that is kind of behind that reality that you were exposed to.
Yeah.
And then you go back to like treaties being agreed to and then being broken. You go back to the Indian Act that put restrictions on Indigenous people that were not restrictions put on settlers that came to settle and make a go here in what became Canada. And you start to see all of these contradictions and just differences, and the story becomes very different. It becomes a story about, well, who is responsible for that, and what can we do about that? It becomes a much different story, doesn't it?
Yeah. So the challenge for us and for everybody listening and for those that are going to be in the class this week is to become aware of our strategies of becoming defensive or denying. So we're just going to become aware of them and not beat ourselves over the head when we have them, but just like be willing to sit with some of the uncomfortable feelings that we may have.
Right.
So let's move to, why don't we move to going through the moves to innocence? So basically, if you are in the class and you can read that whole chapter.
The chapter is chapter 6, the Bloodlines 2 chapter. De-assimilating is the subtitle. And it's really, really worthwhile to put the energy into reading that chapter. There's a lot there that would be what we want to focus on this week and the questions. So let's talk about these moves to innocence, because I think, like you say, they're things that we easily can fall into, and be good to recognize what they are. So from the book, there's a quote saying about, in general, what moves to innocence are, that they're I like how they say this, they're inevitable moments of internal paralysis, that is when we just don't know what to do or we disassociate. The challenge for settlers, that's us, is to stay engaged and present, even as we pay attention to how we reflexively turn to strategies of defensiveness and denial. And I'll say again, that's from Tuck and Yang, Decolonization is Not a Metaphor.
And when thing I really loved later in that chapter was when they talked about this imagined innocence that we so love to put on actually undermines our personal and political ability to respond. So
we lack response ability when we do these things.
Yeah. Hence our use of the term response ability.
Yeah.
Okay. So we're going to go through them actually, right?
Yeah. There's only 10 of them. So yeah. I mean,
we'll be here for another 10 hours. Okay. No, we're going to be quick.
Yeah. We're going to skip over some, and we're going to speak about the ones that are the most important.
So I think the first one, agnosia, I don't know if I'm saying it right, but I think this is a huge one. This is willful ignorance. It's like, we don't know about all that stuff. And we don't want to know what we don't know. And we, in essence, kind of like, well, I don't really care. I don't care and I don't want to care.
Yeah, so, sometimes kind of convenient not to know things.
Yeah. Well, I didn't know that.
I remember hearing this old adage from a conservative Mennonite church that said, yeah, well, you don't want to know too much, because the more you know, the more you're responsible for. Bingo. that's actually very true. But to willfully not know what is knowable is actually a move to innocence.
And I've heard those very words from, you know, people in our own community, not the Seeds community necessarily, but just like that sentiment of, I actually don't want to know more about that, because then I just, then what, right?
Then I might have to do something about it, or I might need to care, or it might actually mess up my self-conception or my conception of my people or whatever. Yeah.
Ignorance is bliss.
Yeah.
Okay.
So yeah. I mean, I just want to say, like, it's good when we've been thinking about our stories, our ancestor lines, is like, we sometimes encounter silences in the story. Well, we didn't, like, there's no talk about that, or nobody said anything about that. And we might want to ask the question, was it actually a historical disappearance? It just got lost. And that happens. We miss out on stuff. We wish we could have asked questions of people that no longer are alive. Or was it actually an unknowing that was actually socialized in our families, so that it was more than just lost, it was something that was avoided? Mm-hmm. I think that's a big one. I don't know if I would ever say, like, well, that I want to be willfully ignorant, but I think we can subtly steer that way by not picking up a book or not being part of a conversation.
Yeah. Okay. The second one is disassociation.
Disassociation. Yeah.
This one I think is also kind of big, because there's a disconnection from history.
Yeah.
Well, my life doesn't have anything to do with this, so I am unaccountable to history. It's not my fault. And this is probably the one that we hear the most, is like, it's not my fault.
Yeah.
This is something that happened in the past. So there's a real choice to detach from the past, like as if there is no connection, which is a very particular kind of blindness.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you see this all over. We've seen it in the last couple of weeks in the conflict that is taking place in the Middle East. And bad things happen in our present day. And there's a lack of understanding about the history that has brought us to where we are today. And so we just think in terms of, with blinders, like, what's happening right now, but we don't ask questions about, well, what happened 50 years ago, 100 years ago, 150 years ago, that set the table for the kind of conflicts that are happening today. And
it reminds me of the name of that book, Mistakes Were Made, But Not By Me.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. The third one, now I'd say the first three are kind of all, they're kind of connected together. And I think we probably would resonate with them. The third one is inheritance without responsibility. And this is basically, history is what it is, but it's not my responsibility. So where we find ourselves today happened, and it's kind of connected to dissociation. We just move on from here. Like, can't we just like that's the past, just like, that's water under the bridge, bygones.
Yeah.
Let's just move forward.
Yeah. The thing that the first three have in common is that they all have a common kind of impetus to separate themselves, to distance themselves from being connected.
Yeah, I think this is it maybe, I don't know, it feels like a real modern problem, like a sense that we are detached from our histories, and we are just individuals moving forward in this world, and we are making our own way, and the past is simply that, the past. We're more thinking about the future and where we're going, and all three of these things kind of lend themselves to that sort of individualistic Western approach. Kind of, I mean, it's kind of connected to a settler approach, that we're too busy getting stuff done to think about how we got here.
And I get how, like, if I think about personal, I don't know, if you think about personal scenarios, like if somebody came to you and talked to you about something your dad did, like, would you be tempted to say, well, like, I didn't do that. Like, why? Like, let's say somebody came to you and was asking something of you because of something your dad did.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think it seems natural to want to distance myself from decisions that were made. But at the same time, I have benefited from, you know, the world that my mom and dad have been a part of. And so, what if that decision meant that I've actually inherited something, or I've had an opportunity because of that decision, and if that harmed somebody else? Like, that would, you know, there's a line there that runs between the decisions of my forebears and where I find myself. Yeah.
And not what if they did.
Yeah.
You did benefit from
Yeah. I mean, I had this thought this past week. We sat down with a number of Indigenous elders from Roseau River First Nation, with a number of people in our community talking about treaty and their understanding of treaty. And it came up again. I've heard this idea about that in the Indigenous mindset worldview, there's a sense that decisions that are made today are thought about how they will impact seven generations from this time. And then it dawned on me, I said, I wonder, like, I've been following this ancestor who came in 1874 to Manitoba, and I realized that our children, our kids, are the seventh generation of that family that came in 1874. And so it puts that whole decisions that were made then have impacted where we are today. And so now let's think seven generations forward.
Yeah, he kind of made a bit of a joke, that the elder that was talking. He was like, you know, if somebody asks something of you to think about, what is the impact? Okay, sorry, hang on a second. Let me just think about seven generations from now. But, you know, he was kind of making light of the fact that we don't think that way, but that we need to think more about how connected we are to people way down the line, to our kin.
Yeah. So it seems worthwhile that we should think backwards about what has happened and integrate that with where we are today.
Yeah.
Okay.
We should move on.
We need to move on. Okay. The next number, number four, is historical determinism. And that's just, we're not going to spend much time on that, but that's basically like, it's human nature. Strong people oppress weak people. Let's get over it. The strong survive. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, as somebody I once heard say, yeah, like, when are they going to just get over it? We won.
Right.
Sometimes I'm amazed that people say things out loud like that. Like,
Well, this is a story. I mean, it's either like, we conquered them, so get with the plan. Just like the English conquered the French in Canada, you know, these are, or it's like, they made a bad deal. Like, I mean, gosh, we make bad deals all the time. Deal with it, right? Is the bottom line. The fifth one, I think, E is fifth. Ideologies of superiority. The various forms of exceptionalism. I think this is very, very natural. You know, our people have a very good work ethic, our ingenuity.
Okay, you have to tell the story about the Mennonite wagons.
Oh, no, I can't. It's too much time.
That's okay, forget it.
Yeah, no.
Okay, another time.
If you ever see me in person and I can tell the story, and it comes from Rhoda, what's her name?
Jansen.
Rhoda Jansen, the author who, like,
Mennonite in a little black dress.
Yeah, she has an appendix about Mennonites and about how great Mennonite buggies are compared to the generic Russian buggies that suck in comparison. But I mean, yeah.
The exceptionalism, I think, I mean, yeah. There's all kinds of different forms of exceptionalism at play in our society. Our work ethic, our ingenuity, our
peacefulness.
Yeah. Our humility.
Yeah.
So exceptional. Yeah.
We were exceptionally humble. Well, it's interesting to say too that, like, what's another word for exceptional? It's like a supremacy, like, you know.
That's right.
We think about white supremacy and like, ooh, like now we're talking about kind of, ooh, that, well, that's what we're not. That's that. Not, that's extreme.
That's right. We're not that.
No, but yeah. Oh, here's a good one. This is a really good one. Intent versus impact. Things may have caused harm, but our hearts or our ancestors' hearts were in the right place. We truly wanted to provide, like, think about it in terms of residential schools. We truly wanted to provide a good education to Indigenous people. So residential schools may have been harmful, but not for a lack of sincerity and approach. Or we've heard some people say recently, well, you know, let's think about all the good things that were provided by residential schools.
Mm-hmm. I think... There's a, yes.
You can't separate intent from impact, like, because impact,
well, intent,
is impactful.
Yes. However, I want to argue with this one just a little bit, because I think intent really does matter. We often talk about that, like, even in our relationships with Indigenous people, like, we'll make mistakes, but our intent does matter. And for instance, a lot of Mennonite families, a woman I was talking to just last week, that again, without the knowledge of, any language of the 60s scoop or anything like that, really took in, wanted to adopt a child because Mennonite Church Canada had a motion that actually really encouraged them to do that, and mm-hmm. they thought they were being responsive, faithful Christians. And so I do think that in a lot of individual family, there was positive intent to care for somebody that they had been told
needed to be
needed
cared
it.
For. Yeah. But when we disentangle ourselves from the thinking that created that scenario, we start to see narratives of supremacy, exceptionalism, where it's sort of like, well, we had something really good to offer. And
so again, in other ways where we want to protect our intent, like when someone tells me that I've had a negative impact on something, but I had an intention for good. That's one of those moves that I can definitely feel in myself, but I didn't mean to do that. That's not what I was saying. That's not what I meant.
Right.
You know, even in a personal dispute between the two of us, it's like, well, your intention or my intention and the impact. So I think, again, the requirement there is, yeah, sometimes, like, that's hard. That's hard to reckon with the fact that maybe in some scenarios, I'm not talking about residential schools here, but there are scenarios where, you know, people in our community say around the 60 scoop, like, I really did have a good intent. And it hurts to know that that's actually what the impact. That to me feels like a good statement. That's like, you wanted to love somebody, you wanted to do something, and now you're seeing that what you were a part of was terrible.
Yeah.
And there, that's different, I think, just again, speaking about this particular woman that I spoke with, just somebody that's committed to that learning and to that reconciliation, and feeling the weight of, wow, I was actually deeply a part of that.
Yeah.
And I didn't mean to.
Yeah. So I think the difference maybe is that when intent is used to shield from impact.
Yes. Yeah.
You know, I think that's why that Maya Angelou quote's so powerful. It's like, you know, I do the best I can. And when I know better, I do better. And so,
yeah,
I think that covers that.
So I think we want to leave spaces where we can admit to things, right?
Where exactly.
Let's admit to things, and have the courage to let go of the shield. Because the shield will just, like, I can't look at the impact because it's too hard.
Yeah.
And if you take that shield away and you still may say, I had a good intent, or my parents had good intent, but wow, that was disastrous for, it was still disastrous for people.
Yeah.
And we somehow have to be able to sit with that.
I think, our time is coming close to the end. So I want to maybe skip through a couple here. After intent versus impact, there was victimization, which we're not going to talk about, but using, putting ourselves into a victim state based on certain understanding, let's say, of affirmative actions, trying to deal with discrepancies in opportunity and people who have actually been privileged by history, saying that now we are somehow being discriminated against when wrongs are trying to be righted in our systems. The next one, I think it's maybe one of the last ones we should talk about. And that's one that people who are more progressive or are engaged in these issues might find themselves. And that's exoneration by conscientization, which basically means, well, we're woke, so we aren't responsible. Mm-hmm. We believe the right things about these issues. So we're not the same as people who don't see things the way we see them. And
it's another kind of superiority.
Yeah. Yeah. And it might mean that we believe the right things, but we don't do anything about it. Like, that was one of the messages we got from one of the elders this week was, he said, I'm tired of lip service. I mean, yeah, it's important to talk about stuff, but I'm tired of lip service. It's time for action. And the time is now. And it's like,
So he would like all the red dots then from our group that first week, because we all wanted...
He's all ready for action, just like yeah. Some of our other group. Yeah, exactly. So
we want people to spend time with those 10 things and to do a little inventory, a little self-inventory, and maybe highlight... What are the ones that are the most, that you're most prone to?
Yeah. Which moves seem the easiest for us to move towards? Yeah, Elaine tells a story in the chapter of feeling those things, you know, being deeply involved in this work and then hearing somebody talk about her home province and community, and just finding it very hard not to get caught up in the shame and the feelings of guilt and just wanting to get that off of her. And I think that's a very human thing that we do. We just, these are difficult circumstances that we're engaged with, and the way forward is sometimes overwhelming. So if we can get ourselves out of it by claiming some moral superiority of innocence, then we will often take that.
Yeah, I think the last three are kind of all ways of kind of putting the blame somewhere else.
Yeah. For sure. Okay, wow. That was, we dealt with a lot there. We've encouraged people to do some of the reading that we suggested. this week, I think it's really important to dig into this chapter six, and we'll be providing questions in the workbook and some of this material that we talked about today. And
I just wanted to say that next week we're going to have Elaine and Ched with us on the podcast.
Yes.
And I'm looking forward to that. And then also they're going to be joining us in the class for a portion of time. So
yeah,
it's going by fast.
Yeah. We discussed today about, wouldn't it be nice to add a couple of extra sessions on at the end to deal with some things that are coming up that we're not finding time to deal with. But I mean, that is the nature of this work and this conversation is, the restorative solidarity model, like it's you move through it. It's a circle and then you repeat and you dig deeper or you peel another layer of the onion and get at it in a way that is deeper than the last time you did it.
Yeah. I'm so excited for them to hear from Elaine and Ched directly. Yeah. I just feel like you're going to love them.
All right. We look forward to seeing you in class this weekend and continuing the conversation in the next couple of weeks on the podcast. So take care and all the best as you work through this stuff.
Yes. Amen.
Amen. Bye-bye. Take care.